This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Sarah Ashworth in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. To much fanfare, Southern New Hampshire University recently announced that the U.S. Department of Education endorsed its experimental, competency-based education program. It's called College for America. That means federal loan dollars will support a degree based on, as the university president recently called it, what you have learned, not how long you have sat in a chair. Another higher education headline here in the state, New England College will offer a three-year degree that can translate to hefty savings when it comes to tuition and housing. It's all part of a trend that's gained momentum as college costs keep rising and student debt soars. New Hampshire ranks first when it comes to highest average student debt load. In response, colleges and universities are trying to offer more flexible and affordable programs. Some, though, worry that these programs might end up cutting academic corners and amount to getting less for less. Others say the benefits of a broad liberal arts education could be lost for the next generation of students. And let's hear from you. What do you think of this trend in higher education? Are you on board with these changes, including the three-year degree in online learning? Do you see these as important innovations, or do you worry that they may be sacrificing academic substance in the interest of affordability? Call in. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477 or 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or send a question or comment through our Facebook page. And our guest for the hour, Paul LeBlanc, is here in studio with me. He's president of Southern New Hampshire University, which has received federal approval for competency-based education programs. Good morning.
Nice to be here, Sarah.
And Daniel Hurley joins us from Washington, D.C. He's director of state relations and policy analysis for the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. Welcome, Daniel.
Good morning.
And Goldie Blumenstick, she's senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. She also joins us on the line from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. So I want to start with you, Paul LeBlanc. As we just mentioned, Southern New Hampshire University has launched a pilot $5,000 online competency-based associate degree. You're completely doing away with the credit hour, it sounds like. So to start out, can you explain what a competency-based education program is?
Sure. So when we think about most college degree programs, you think about an aggregate of three credit hour courses. And this is how students and families and all of higher education thinks about it this way. It's how we organize curricula and resource allocation and financial aid. Competency-based programs take various forms, and they've been around for a while. I think ours is a dramatic term because there are no three credit hour courses at all. There are 120 competencies that our students master in order to earn an associate's degree. And it's equivalent to 60 credit hours, but
okay,
it's not credit hours.
So what's an example of a competency? What are a couple of competencies students would pass?
Sure. There are nine clusters of competencies, and there are areas like communications, so the ability to write well, the ability to present. There's a competency cluster on quantitative reasoning, so the ability to do problem solving and using numbers. And there's soft skills, by the way, that employers tell us are very important, the ability to give and take instruction or to work in teams. And then there are skills that are closely aligned to the idea of a major. So in our first iteration of the program, which focuses on business skills, using tools like spreadsheets, understanding marketing. Overlaying all of that are a set of critical thinking skills as well, so the ability for students to synthesize knowledge. In terms of outcomes, it looks like a college degree. In terms of delivery, it feels very different in how it's structured.
So a student would make a spreadsheet or so and then be able to show an online advisor or a tutor, somebody, here, I can do this, now on to the next competency?
So close. So the person doing the evaluation are faculty. So they're trained and they look traditional in terms of their preparation and their backgrounds. And they get these submitted tasks and they have a rubric that really closely and clearly defines what that competency is. And they assess those students or review that work against that. Of course, it's more than simply making a spreadsheet. So all of the tasks tend to be more complicated hypotheticals in which the students have to bring to bear multiple competencies at the same time. Because that's how we use competencies in the real world. No one does a spreadsheet in isolation. It's with other things.
And so this is really a partnership with employers around the state as well. How does that work?
So right now, we only enroll students who are employed by one of our corporate partners. So we have people like Globe Manufacturing, Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Riverwoods Retirement Community. These are all Moore Center in Manchester. These are all large New Hampshire employers. And we use the workplace as a kind of affinity group. So it's really important to these adult learners. Remember, we're not talking about 18-year-olds and a coming-of-age experience on a traditional campus. We're talking about very, very busy adults. Our program is geared towards people who are on the lower rungs of the organizational chart, often hourly workers. And for them, their third priority is education. First family, then work, then education. They're trying to make this work in the midst of a very busy life. So the workplace becomes a real important affinity location where they can connect. We have employees organizing meetups. They want to know who else in their company is working on a competency. They can do that through the platform. They can help each other. There's a lot of peer-to-peer learning.
Okay. So how did this get started at SNHU?
So we've been doing competency-based education for a long time in the form of a 3-year degree program that's been around for 15 years. And that's still more traditionally mapped to courses. In 2011, we had this notion of, can we really more dramatically deconstruct or disaggregate the components of the learning process? And could we drive down price for a population that's not being very well served by the incumbent higher ed providers? So when you talk about a $5,000 degree, it's actually a $1,250 for every 6 months.
If it took 2 years, it would be
$5,000. But we have people who will be on pace to complete their associate's degree in under 12. So they'll have earned their associate's degree for $2,500. And that's a big number and an important factor for the people that we're serving in this population.
Hey, Paul, are the employers paying some of this tuition? Is that part of your arrangement?
Yeah, so...
Goldie, by the way.
Yeah, Goldie from The Chronicle. In many cases, the employer reimbursement is actually higher than the annual tuition costs. So the answer is yes. There are some cases where that benefit or support is not available, and this is why our ability to access Pell Grants for those students is really important. And then there are employers in the middle who don't quite cover the whole cost but are doing some pretty creative things. In one case, there's a modest $40 a month payment for the balance that the employer does through payroll deduction. But when that student completes, they rebate all of that difference and cover any remaining balance, which is kind of a nice incentive for completion.
So Goldie Blumenstig, the U.S. Department of Education seems to be endorsing this. In March, it released a letter that encouraged colleges to seek federal approval for degree programs that maybe don't rely on the traditional credit hour. Why do you think the Department of Education is beginning to support programs like this?
Well, for one thing, there's a lot of hue and cry in the country right now about the cost of college. And there's been a great big push. Paul's college has been part of this from a number of colleges that want to provide competency-based programs, and they want to be able to do this a little more seamlessly through the Education Department's financial aid programs, I think. There's some 20 colleges that have programs like this in the works or are planning to have them, and I think they were all part of a consortium along with Southern New Hampshire that actually met with the Education Department earlier this year. I guess it was back in November to sort of encourage them because they were getting what they would call mixed signals from the Education Department. On the books, these kinds of programs are allowed. In reality, a lot of people have been wondering whether they could really do it. There's a 15-year-old university out there called Western Governors University that was created by, guess what, the governors of the West way back when. It's been around for a while. It now has about 40,000 students, and it's been awarding competency-based degrees for that many years, but as Paul points out, they haven't technically been doing that because sort of officially they convert all these competencies into credits and then they go ahead and award the degrees that way. But they use similar kind of approach from what Paul just described with sort of a mapping system and mapping competencies to certain things. But there are a bunch of other colleges out there that want to do this, and there's a lot of push in the country nationwide for getting more students college education.
So, Daniel Hurley, what do you think of this competency-based model and how it's starting to catch on at some different colleges?
Well, first I'd like to congratulate President LeBrinc and his leadership team. They really have made waves nationally with this new model, and the support of the U.S. Department of Education has been, you know, a big win. And so I think it reflects, you know, a significant. There's been a lot of talk about disruption in American higher education, and I think this is like one more significant step that really affirms that taking place. And as Goldie said, I think it's part of a broader quest for, you know, college affordability, college access. It's not just about affordability, but access as well, given online technology. So it's not just New Hampshire, you know, students, but those from the Northeast and beyond. But then also really a quest for greater innovation in, you know, higher education program delivery. And, you know, I think all three of those combined will, you know, collectively make a significant difference. And so I think that what the university is doing is very exciting. There's no doubt it's probably a little nerve-wracking for some of the other traditional institutions, both in the public and private nonprofit sector. But I think there's going to be a lot of attention paid to how what the student kind of consumer market demand is like, and what the outcomes. A lot of the focus is on affordability and access, but ultimately it's about quality. And so, you know, what the students have to say, the graduates of these programs down the road have to say about their experience, and perhaps most importantly, what the employers have to say about, you know, the product, so to speak, the graduates of these competency-based programs.
Do you think, Daniel, that this is being driven mainly by employers, or is it out of affordability? What do you think is really pushing this program?
I think President Blank would be in a better position to answer that, but I would think that it's actually probably more from a student perspective, especially, again, the non-traditional adult working student. That is an important, very important demographic, especially in the Northeast New England, where it's those kind of non-working, non-degree completers that are going to be real key to bolstering the workforce of the future. So there's no doubt employers have had a voice as well, but I think it's the student consumer demand.
Okay, and we'll pick up on that after a break. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. More of The Exchange coming up. 10 o'clock this morning, we'll be joining NPR for a special coverage, a presidential news conference. That comes your way at 10 here on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, lots of sunshine across the state today, especially in the northern half. Highs 65 to 70 degrees, cooler along the seacoast. Clear to partly cloudy tonight, lows in the 30s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from A&B Lumber and Home Centers, featuring windows and doors by Marvin and Integrity. For remodeling or replacement projects in Pembroke, Moultonboro, and at ablumber.com. From Mill Travel, American Express, and their nearly 100 local travel professionals, providing business travel service and travel management to New Hampshire businesses since 1975. And Concord Regional Visiting Nurse Association, offering better choices, better health, a program to help older adults self-manage their chronic condition beginning May 2nd in Pembroke. This is NHPR.
And this is The Exchange. I'm Sarah Ashworth in for Laura Kanoy today. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about the debate over innovations that may reduce college cost, but perhaps sometimes at the cost of the price of education quality. We invite you to join us at 1-800-982-6477 or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. We're going to go now to Paul LeBlanc, the president of Southern New Hampshire University. We were talking right before the break about who's driving some of these competency-based education reforms, and you were talking a little bit about employers and what you hear from them. What do you hear from them?
Sure. So there's a moment in every presentation to potential employer partners where we say, have you hired somebody with a college degree who doesn't write very well? Have you hired somebody with a college degree that you wouldn't put in front of a room of important customers or clients? Have you hired somebody with a college degree that would struggle to read a balance sheet and understand sort of the sort of numbers you put in front of them? And it's like touching a nerve. Employers talk about this all the time. And I think 40 years ago, a college degree was a signal. And it really was a signal that people had critical thinking skills and good communication skills and could do the kind of work that we're talking about. That's no longer true in the minds of many employers. And in fact, there was a recent study, Goldie, maybe you know the citation here, but I think it was about a week ago, in which something like 65% of universities thought that they were preparing their graduates well for the workforce, while the inverse number, about 65% of employers thought the college graduates weren't well prepared for the workforce in their careers. So there is a gap. And I think everyone has to agree that however you think about that gap exists today. So employers have been incredibly responsive to our saying to them, we will make 120 claims for what our students know and can do. We will define that precisely, and then we will show you the evidence of their mastery in an electronic portfolio. So when we say somebody can present well, you don't have to guess. Here's the rubric. Here's the definition of what that means. And if you don't trust us, take a look at the electronic portfolio and watch the video of them presenting in front of a group of people. This is really powerful. On the quality issue, I think we are pretty confident about what kinds of graduates we'll produce. The place where I'm less confident is this, that it's not going to be easy. You can't slide by with a C in college writing. When you do our competencies, there are only two states, you've mastered or not yet. And if you're still in not yet, you don't have a degree in hand. That's not true for a lot of who comes out of college today, frankly.
So, Daniel, do you think that that is rigorous enough, or how do you make sure that you keep programs like this academically rigorous?
Well, I mean, I think it's important, again, to have that, we talked about mapping, but to have the outcomes, the student outcomes, very detailed for both the, you know, student and employer, so that expectations are set at the outset. And I do like the idea of, you know, the, you know, either you're qualified or you're not, and not to have all that gray area. And I think that as long as the standards are rigorous, then it should, you know, outcomes should show promise.
And Goldie Blumenstick, is there any kind of stigma that's attached to some of these degrees, whether it's competency-based education, which I guess we'll find out in a few years, but online degrees or other different innovative types of degrees? Is there any kind of stigma that attaches to these diplomas when students go out to look for jobs?
I mean, there is still now a stigma, even to online degrees. The employer survey, I think, which is what Paul was just referring to, that we just did, I don't have the number right in front of me, but there was still some doubt among employers about students with online degrees, which, you know, even though that's somewhat a pervasive technology these days. I wanted to sort of make another point. One of the reasons I think that helps the competency-based movement a little bit is just the thing that Paul talked about. Right now, people come out of college and you don't actually know what they know. You have a signal because they have a diploma, but you don't have that much more. And I think one of the vulnerabilities right now in traditional higher education is people don't really know what students know coming out of college. In a way, this competency program will address that a little bit, because here these students coming out of college will have a portfolio and a thing to show their employers. There are some traditional colleges that are doing this as well and pushing this more and, you know, pushing on the portfolio movement. And some students are even starting to submit their GRE tests and things like that. Additional credentials and additional forms of sort of verification that shows I didn't just major in history. I know how to understand history and I can explain history. I didn't just major in accounting. Here's what I can do with accounting. So the fact that many colleges don't require this yet, but competency-based programs do, sort of shows one of the reasons why a competency-based degree could have some legs, I guess, in the market out there.
And Daniel Hurley, is there any way that this could threaten to divide, you know, groups of students into haves and have-nots, the students who get this sort of degree, the students who get a traditional four-year liberal arts degree, and from families who maybe have higher incomes who can send their kids to these traditional schools, and then, you know, do lower-income students end up going this competency-based path, and are we creating a tiered system?
That's a good question, but I don't think that this latest approach to programming by Southern New Hampshire University is anyhow changing what currently exists out there in terms of community colleges versus regional state colleges, universities, versus the University of New Hampshire research flagship, and then the whole set of more expensive private liberal arts colleges. So the, you know, issue in terms of, you know, social equity and stratification as it, you know, involves students and families and the current existing American higher education system is still in place. You know, this will slightly add to it, but I actually think that, again, it'll be very interesting that if there is a strong quality dimension to this, the convenience factor could be helpful in, you know, bringing on a kind of a new set of demographic that might be higher academic achieving and be able to afford more expensive alternatives, but choose to go this online competency-based route.
And Paul LeBlanc, were these discussions that you had around the table as you were putting together this program talking about how you keep from creating a tiered system?
Sure. So I think, and Dan alluded to this, there are many higher eds in America. We tend to, I think, be a little sloppy in our discussions and our debates about where higher ed is headed today. So I'm going to say, which higher ed? Because there's traditional residential living on campus and coming of age higher ed that we sort of think about, you know, the 18-year-olds. That's the minority of college students today. The great bulk of college students today are adult or non-traditional learners, and they sort of get their education a variety of ways, and they get it increasingly online. They're voting with their feet for lots of good reasons we could discuss. There's a research higher ed. UNH is a good local example of that, and that's not going to change. I would disagree with Dan just a little bit. I think that for those institutions or those sectors that educate working adults, I think this stands to be a disruptive influence. Now, it can be a positive one in which everyone starts to think harder about how they demonstrate the learning and the outcomes, and accreditors have tried to do that for a long time. But I also think the cost is really going to be a threat in many ways. And we've heard from a lot of community colleges who have said, hey, we'd like to partner with you because you're serving our students and we're trying to figure out how to make this work and we're interested.
So we want to turn now to another college in New Hampshire that's taking another approach, New England College. And joining me on the line now is Mark Wattman. He's Vice President for Academic Affairs at New England College. The college will soon offer a way for students to earn a bachelor's degree in 3 years rather than the typical four-year path. Beginning this May, the college will pilot 2 7-week terms with bigger tuition breaks and free housing over the summer. So welcome, Mark Wattman, to the program.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. And why create this faster track?
Yeah, really for many of the same issues that you've been discussing. You know, the demographics of students entering higher education have changed. We have many more adult working students who want access to education that is flexible and that is at an accelerated pace. We have seen that we are not maximizing our use of our facilities, and if we really re-envision what it means to have a traditional campus and utilize it year-round, we can offer a much more cost-effective education to our students.
And so students will take classes over the summer. What is typically right now at New England College in Henniker there, what is the summer like? Is it pretty dead on campus?
It's quiet. We've had varying levels of summer programming, but we really haven't made an effort to capitalize on the use of our facilities and really optimal enrollment for the traditional student as well as working adults in the summer. So now it's really envisioning the campus as a full functional, you know, educational institution year-round, 12 months.
Do you worry whether students are going to be able to sustain the pace of year-round school for 3 years? That can mean a loss of opportunities for internships or having to work over the summer. What kind of student would this fit for?
I think it fits for a different number of students. I think that there'll always be the traditional, you know, 18-year-old entering student who wants to, you know, go fall and spring semesters, and they may be involved in traditional academic interests as well as athletic interests. But there's a growing population, not only of traditional age students, but of you know, adult students who are returning to education after some time, who are looking for an accelerated path. They want to enter the workforce earlier. They want to maximize their earning, you know, capabilities. And for them, you know, an accelerated pace to a degree is a priority.
And how much do you think a student can save who does this 3-year path rather than the 4-year path?
Well, we haven't mapped that out specifically, but right now our tuition for summer courses is $200 per credit with free housing. So for our traditional students, it's extremely cheap to incentivize them to start using the summer months. We were not capitalizing on that use, you know, for our internal students for the last number of years, and because we weren't looking to make a profit, we're able to lower our prices and really meet some of President Obama's call to reduce the cost of higher education for our citizens.
And what kind of response have you had from students? How many do you expect might be on campus this summer?
It's hard to tell. We've just started in our internal enrollment. I would imagine we'll have over 100 or 200 students starting for the summer months. The response has been terrific. We found that students are really interested in capitalizing on internship opportunities as well. So we have aligned a lot of our course curriculum in the summer with specific internship opportunities for students. So that notion of still getting, you know, practice for future jobs and job training is really part of the package as well at NEC.
And Mark Wattman, if you could stay with us on the line for just a couple more minutes. Daniel Hurley, I want to turn to you. You co-wrote a paper I saw titled "The 3-Year Bachelor's Degree, Reform Measure or Red Herring?" So I want to ask you, what did you find?
Well, we certainly applaud efforts by institutions to, you know, provide a 3-year bachelor's degree option, and we assume that there has been, you know, plenty of market analysis that there is sufficient demand for it. And so, for example, for New England College to take on this initiative and provide a supplementary, you know, opportunity in New Hampshire, I think is fine. Where we take issue a little bit is that you have some policymakers. I would cite U.S. Senator Lamar Alexander, who I think, you know, ascribes this as a massive public policy solution to American college affordability. I think when you look at, and this was alluded to, you look at the financial wherewithal and the academic achievement capability required to get through a 3-year degree, and that really is a very small slice of the population. And right now, most students attend public universities in this country, and we are failing to graduate 6 out of every 10 of those students within 6 years. So from, again, a mass, you know, public policy perspective, we need to focus from a federal-state institutional partnership how we can do a better job graduating the students that are already enrolled as opposed to focusing a lot of efforts on getting a smaller, you know, niche of students through in 3 years as opposed to 4.
And Mark Wattman, are you doing things at New England College to help get those more traditional students through school in 4 years?
Absolutely. And I would like to echo that I'm very much in agreement with those sentiments. The 3-year program, the accelerated program, is good for a certain, you know, a certain student who's highly motivated. But again, you know, one of our you know, main focuses really needs to be on the quality of education, so that our students, when they leave with their degree, you know, are entering the workforce in ways that they're capable of, you know, having long careers in different industries as you know the world changes. So we're really I'm fascinated with the competency-based education models that are now popping up. A set of common core competencies is something I think all institutions should be looking at more critically to see if that is something that we can get some agreement on moving forward. So I agree that, you know, the models of higher education are changing rapidly, and they need to. We are an industry that's in somewhat of crisis, and it provides us with wonderful opportunities to reinvent, you know, traditional notions of what it means to become educated and how that happens. So I would really imagine that over the next number of years, we'll see several new and innovative models, just like the one at SNU, that's popping up, and it will be fascinating to see what direction it leads us.
And Paula Blanc, I want to ask you, SNHU has already created a three-year model. Is it in business administration or some other courses? What have you found from
that?
So
we have really good data on this, and it resonates with some of what Dan has said. We've been doing this for about 15 years. We have a little bit of a different model, and Dan's paper has a nice taxonomy of the kinds of three-year programs. So ours is not an accelerated move more courses into a three-year period. Ours is really six semesters, so traditional academic year, in which we've used a competency-based approach to kind of take overlap out of the system and do more project-based learning. So we have 87% of our students in that program stay with us from the first to second year, compared to 73% nationally. 78% of the students in that program graduate versus 50% nationally. Of those 22% who don't graduate on time, half of those simply move over into our four-year program. So our graduation rate really is something closer to 90%. So and there is, as Dan suggested, it's a slice of our overall student body, just over 100 students out of the 2,800 on campus at any given time. But these are high performers, and it works well for them. And in terms of cost, it saves them 25% off the cost of a bachelor's degree. And also remember, they enter the workforce a year earlier, so they get a year's worth of earnings, which I think on average in America today is somewhere in the mid-40s or low-40s. So you take that in totality, it's a big impact on family finance.
And Goldie Blumenstig, this isn't exactly new. I know students have always been able to take AP credits or get credits before they actually get to college to graduate early. But are you seeing a bigger push for universities to do this specialized three-year program?
I'm actually just seeing a bigger push broadly to keep students on track to get through college. I mean, they always say time is the enemy for students to graduate, right? And they even measure the graduation rate nationally by a six-year rate because many students can't complete it in 4 years. So there's a lot more movement, I think, for 3-year degree, a little less excitement maybe than there was 2 or 3 years ago. I think there's a lot more movement in helping students move a little more seamlessly through from a 2-year college to a 4-year college without losing a lot of credits. There's a big push in Arizona State University does that. California has made a big push about having a more seamless path. I actually had a question about the 3-year degree at them.
And let's actually do that. We're going to take a short break now. We'll ask that question after the break. Mark Wattman is Vice President for Academic Affairs at New England College. I want to thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
And we'll be back after a short break on The Exchange.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and Antioch University New England, now offering a holistic special education Master of Education degree with both general and special education teacher certification, antiochne.edu. And Clark Mortensen, provider of specialized insurance and risk management for New Hampshire residential care homes, online at clarkmortensen.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, after the Oval Office, political junkie Ken Rudin explores the public and private lives of ex-presidents. And Jane Austen, game theorist, a mathematician proposes that the author may be the unacknowledged founder of the discipline favored by politicians and economists. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth rolls the dice on Mr. Darcy. Today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Sarah Ashworth, in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on the program, the 100th anniversary of the income tax, why we have it, and early alternatives. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for that discussion. But today we're talking about higher education and innovations in higher education. The guests this hour are Paul LeBlanc. He's president of Southern New Hampshire University. Daniel Hurley is director of state relations and policy analysis for the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. And Goldie Blumenstick is senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. And Goldie, I believe right before we went to break, you had a question you wanted to ask.
I don't know if Mark is still on the line.
He's not.
One of the questions I have about these colleges, Paul's, Southern New Hampshire and New England College, when they expand these programs, who are the faculty who teach this? Because I think that is a big, we haven't heard that word yet today, faculty, in this discussion. It's very easy to sort of bring in a lot of adjunct professors who are, in effect, delivering someone else's courses. But when colleges are expanding these programs to a three-year degree or even with competency-based programs and having faculty approve it, I always sort of wonder who this faculty is. And that's sort of the biggest disruption going on right now in higher education, what these innovations and disruptive approaches are doing to sort of the traditional faculty. Maybe Paul could talk a little bit about the faculty at Southern New Hampshire, because, I mean, I'm as I was listening to him describe it, I had a hard time sort of distinguishing that from just some of these, you know, credentialing services that are out there, like that the Adult Learning Association provides, for example. There are ways to get competency-based credits now. So how is it different from when you go through it?
So, Paul LeBlanc, who's teaching courses there?
Sure. And I think Goldie makes a good point. I think in some ways, in all of the talk about disruption in higher education, we have tended to duck the issue of the displacement of traditional faculty roles. So in our traditional three-year, in our longstanding three-year program on campus, the full-time faculty teach in that program, and it's no different than the rest of the university in terms of faculty role. But in terms of College for America, the new competency-based program, part of what allows us to deconstruct and sort of think about how to deliver differently is a disaggregation of almost every part of the learning process. You sort of pull it apart and say, how do we do it differently? How do we drive cost out? So if I can digress for a moment, there are no textbook purchases. We use open education resources, and all of those are available for free to our students. On the faculty role is disaggregated as well, and our faculty would be involved on the front end. So that's through the work on the competencies and in on the curation of learning materials and the content, et cetera. And faculty are involved on the back end, that is, in reviewing student work. But they're not involved in the notion of direct instruction. And that sort of very traditional centerpiece role is pulled out of the model. And that certainly helps drive the cost down. The question then becomes, what replaces the faculty if students don't have those traditional faculty to turn to? And our bet is, and what we'll see borne out, I think, in the results, is that students learn very effectively when you put in front of them a combination of high-quality content and learning materials, peer-to-peer learning, workplace mentorship, good advising, and the access to a faculty member at those critical moments when none of the things I've just listed work, and you still need somebody to say, why don't I get this process of how to convert X to Y? And that's where faculty will come in, but it's much more in a just-in-time process.
And the number to join us on the exchange today with your questions or comments is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. And Goldie Blumenstick, does that answer your question about who's teaching these courses?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, there is this notion of I know it's not just about sort of job security, which is, of course, a very big issue for faculty as well, but there is this notion, whether valid or not, that at a college, there are departments, they create a curriculum. The curriculum is supposed to make some sense. It's based on sort of, generations and generations of years of learning about what's a history major, what's an accounting major, what's a biology major. And I still wonder, with all these disruptive models, who's making those decisions and how is the student relating to the people who are making those decisions? There are organizations out there that talk a little bit about, the foundations of higher education, that it's not just a grab bag of courses, that, that there's a sort of an approach to this that, your freshman year should prepare you for your sophomore year, for your junior year, for your senior year, that there's a sequence and that you develop a little bit of information along the way and a little more sophistication as a student along the way. And I often wonder about these models, whether these new disruptive models do that. And I also, frankly, also wonder, the people who are promoting some of these models, if this is the kind of education, they would want for their own families.
Golda, can I respond to that, Sarah? So, Golda, I think you're conflating a series of questions. So one is program coherence. I think that's a fair question to ask. But I wouldn't conflate program coherence necessarily residing with a traditional faculty role. I think there are lots of ways of getting at that. I think you conflate the question of, you know, traditional coming of age, what one might want for one's children, with where a lot of these programs are directed, which is a very different problem, working adults who are trying to juggle all these other constraints.
Well, I didn't even say children. I'm thinking families, but, you know, just thinking generally. Someone else is, well, I want my spouse to have this kind of education.
Right. So it depends on what problems your spouse is trying to solve. And if that, if it's a convenience and cost, and I want to know that employers will value, I think that's a different answer than it is if my spouse wants the kind of time to have long conversations with faculty between classes and over an espresso. And I think we romanticize and extend traditional notions of how that education is delivered to the huge population of people who are not very well served by the incumbent models.
So, Paul, I write a lot about for-profit colleges and adult education and adult students. I'm not trying to mythologize the frat party experience and all that silliness. I do think, though, there's a reason people get a college education instead of just going to the library and reading all the books. There is something about interacting with a higher education faculty, whether online or in person, but in some context, that it's different than just studying up and, you know.
But that's a red herring, right? No one, I'd like to think that no one who's thinking seriously about this is coming up with a sort of paltry version of studying in a library in isolation and just taking the test. I would say, and I think you may have been alluding to this, there's been a lot of bad online education. And I think there will be, and I think the department has been very leery about competency-based because they don't want to see happen with competency-based education what they saw with online education in the 90s, which is when they opened it up finally. Who rushed into that space? Not the traditional incumbent providers, but the big for-profits, and not all of them were savory actors in that act.
And Daniel Hurley, I want to jump in here with you. This gets back to this idea of the college experience, and how important is it to try to preserve this, what we romanticize perhaps as the college experience of freshmen taking off, going to school, staying in a dorm, spending time with professors and meeting students? How important is that to our college system, and is it worth trying to preserve, or should we be looking beyond that?
I think it's a little of both. You know, we speak about the college experience, and it's, you know, the experience is one thing, but it's really the outcomes of that experience. And I think that one thing that's often missed in this broader discussion are the softer kind of life skills, knowledge, abilities, intellect that one gains from, you know, a residential experience, whether it's, you know, a greater understanding of, you know, the humanities, social sciences, whether it's building, you know, your own character and a set of values, which I think is very important, maybe even more important than kind of, you know, hard skills for a workforce or, you know, a marketplace that, you know, those specific skills are constantly changing. So I think that, again, that's one thing that we're, you know, I think privileged to have in this country is a remarkable diverse array of institutions. And so, as Paul had indicated, students can select what is best for them. And I think that the residential experience, despite what some cynics may say, will continue to be strong. I think that is very, very important. And the students that go through that experience are all the wealthier in the long run, both you know, financially and intellectually.
The number to join our conversation again is 1-800-892-6477. Let's go to Brittany, who's calling from Sandown. Good morning, Brittany.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
So I am graduating from UNH Durham this year with a double major in psychology and women's studies and a minor in African American studies. And I've done the 4-year, you know, straight out of college, sort of coming of age residential program that, you know, has been talked about. And I think, while I understand the benefit of these, you know, these competency-based educational programs, you know, for the working parent or, you know, for the non-traditional student, I think it loses some of the essence of what higher education, like, traditionally was and really should be. We're sort of commodifying, you know, something that is a right or something that we, you know, I guess you can say romanticized. Maybe, but the value in, you know, being able to get two majors and being able to explore your world and understand the world differently. Like, higher education used to be about becoming a better citizen, becoming a better person, you know, enriching yourself so you can enrich your community. And I think that the, like, fast track, you know, get the same degree that I have in half the time or in less time for less money is sort of taking away from the value of what a higher education degree, like, really is and should be. I just think that our culture is moving toward a fast pace, like, you know, less time, more for your dollar, like, get as much in as you can, like, hurry through it and just get the skills where, like, what's the rush? You know, like, your education and learning how to be, like, a better citizen does take time, and being a critical thinker is something that you can't really learn, like, from a computer screen. You know, you have to have that engagement in class, and well, you have to have that time, so...
Well, that's a good point, and thank you for your call today, Brittany. And Paula Blanc, I want to turn to you. Are we in danger of creating very job-specific job training centers and speeding up the entire process, or do we have to have one at the expense of the other?
So I don't think it's one at the expense of the other. The caller's experience is the sort of archetypal college experience that everyone hopes for their children. I do worry that will be increasingly out of the reach, financially speaking, of many families. And it's very hard to economize. There's lots of debate about how can we keep that within the reach of families. But I don't think the degree we're talking about is, and I don't think the model that we're talking about serves the 37 to 40 million working adults who have zero to few credits and who live in a world where 70% of all new jobs will need a two-year degree or its equivalent. So when I think about the students we serve with College for America, I think of our Troy, Ohio, ConAgra food plant where they make Slim Jims and frozen pizzas, three shifts a day. Those people are wearing their sort of paper hats and their ear protection, and they're coming off the line when they come to our open house to talk about their degree. There's no version of what you just heard that's available to them. It would be nice if it had been, but they're not plugging out of their life of children and families and mortgages and car payments to do that. So the critical thing for us is, can we give them a two-year degree that includes some of what the caller talked about? So there's competencies in our model around civic engagement. There's a lot of critical thinking in this mix. Can I give you just one quick example?
Sure, very quickly.
And it's not going to feel very instrumentalist. One of the competencies requires students to read a number of articles on the theories of curation, how one curates an art exhibit. And then they have to choose from a library of virtual art objects, and they have to curate an exhibit. Then they have to write in a paper that explains what drove their choices and what philosophies and theories they used and what they didn't. That feels like critical thinking to me. That feels like college work. It isn't in the setting that the caller evoked, but that setting is not available to these students, and it's not being provided by traditional higher ed today.
And Daniel Hurley, I want to turn to you. We're talking a lot about preparing students for jobs and training for jobs and skills directly applied to jobs. I wonder, though, for students today in their lifetime, we, in some sense, have no idea what jobs might look like at the end of their careers. How do we prepare for those types of jobs in these programs?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And that, you know, especially in this new, you know, always faster-paced global economy working, and they always say there's a certain percentage of jobs that are going to exist 5 years down the road that we're not even aware of now. So I think there needs to be, you know, a good never losing sight of the strong core set of transferable skills. One comment, sir, I'd like to mention,
sure,
that this discussion has been about innovation in higher ed delivery, and that's an important one. It's at the forefront of a lot of state and federal national policy discussions. But one thing I think is important to not lose sight of is the broader mission of higher education. And when you look at, again, there's certainly a role for a lot of different actors, but when you look at, for example, University of New Hampshire, it's about educating, you know, our future workforce, but it is also significantly, given the land-grant mission there, it involves tremendous amount of outreach and partnership with the states involving everything from healthcare to K-12 education, the environment, social issues, economic development. Same could be said for institutions like Keene State College or Plymouth State University in terms of the impact on their communities and regions. So a lot of times that is, it's pushed by the wayside, and it's all the focus when it comes to colleges is on affordability or the types of programs and how it's delivered. That's important, but I think it's very important for the public, for policymakers to understand and appreciate and embrace that broader mission of public institutions specifically, and as well as the outreach, civic engagement of other types of colleges and universities.
And Goldie Blumenstick, as we look at reforming education, what might that mean, as Daniel Hurley there just mentioned, for research and community impact of universities?
Well, I think that Dan's exactly right. One thing I wonder about is, Claude used the term commodification before, and I thought that was an interesting term because there is a little bit of this industrialization going on in higher education as a whole. I think as the faculty job market gets changed, I mean, people like to think about professors as kind of having this cushy life, but many of them work very hard, and many of them do public service research that affects their communities and affects, you know, the health and welfare of their communities. And I think some of that, if the more these disruptions come along and kind of change the role, the changing role of the faculty, the harder it will be to have faculty who can do this kind of public service research.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests for joining us today on the phone. Goldie Blumenstick, she's a senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Daniel Hurley, Director of State Relations and Policy Analysis for the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. And here in the studio, Paul LeBlanc, he's president of Southern New Hampshire University, which has received federal approval for a competency-based education program. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Sarah Ashworth in for Laura Kanoy.